All right, we've now reached the point of what was going to be Girona 4. And here it is, only Girona 3. But that's all right. So here's our iconic comparison, which I want to return to briefly, just to remind you how different the artificers are. Here are the termites, and there's Gaudí. Well, they're quite different. Now, there is a reason why the termite does what it does, and clever biologists can figure out those reasons. But it's not the case that the termite has a reason for what it does. Whereas Gaudí did have reasons for what he did, not always good reasons, but he really had reasons. Whereas termites don't have reasons. They act for reasons, but they don't have reasons. I want to explain what I mean by that. And my apparently ill-chosen term for this is free-floating rationales. It's too late to change it. I introduced it 20 years ago plus. It gives some people, I don't know, the metaphysical heebie-jeebies or something. They think I'm talking about some sort of mystical, ethereal, free-floating reasons. Yeah? These ghost reasons or something. All I meant by it was they aren't anchored in any minds. They're not represented anywhere. So let me just illustrate and clarify the point. Trees do things for reasons. They don't have minds. But they do things for reasons. They spread their roots. They spread their branches. They shed their leaves. They do all sorts of things for reasons. Fungi do things for reasons. Mushrooms don't have minds. But they do things for reasons. Bacteria do things for reasons. In fact, the whole biotic world is just saturated with reasons from the molecular scale on up. We do things for reasons. We shiver, we vomit, we blink for reasons, but we don't have reasons for doing that, unless, I don't know, an actor on the stage, maybe. You can blink intentionally for a reason, but most of the time when you blink, there is a reason, but you're not blinking for a reason that you have. And it's important to recognize that we can be quite sure that even when we don't know what the reason is. Nobody knows yet why we yawn. There's bound to be a reason. We just don't know what it is yet. It doesn't stop us from yawning, and it doesn't stop there being a reason for yawning. Just we don't know what it is. And it may, of course, not be a what for. It may be a how come, after all. It may just be a vestigial byproduct, a spandrel of something that does have a reason. But this is a topic for inquiry. So, as you will notice, what I'm saying is a bit unsettling at first. There were reasons before there were reasoners. Now, some people want to say, well, now that's a contradiction in terms. Well, let's compare it to this. There were numbers long before there were counters. That is, arithmeticians. What do I mean by that? Do I mean something spooky about Platonic entities, timeless entities? I could, but I don't think that's necessary. I don't think you have to go that far. All I mean really is that, you know, dinosaurs had two eyes. Jupiter has had 67 moons since long before there was life on Earth. And the difference between gold and mercury is the difference between 79 electrons and 80 electrons. So there were numbers before there was arithmetic. But there were no representations of numbers. And there were reasons before there were reasoners, but there were no representations of reasons. In fact, we're the first representers of reasons. Now, these aren't the only concepts or things that work this way. Let's consider this. Were there colors before there was color vision? That's sort of a philosophical chestnut. I found this photograph of some strata, some stria, and some rocks. And you see this green stripe between the red bits there. Was that visible before there were creatures with color vision? Well, notice you can't answer that question. Visible to what? To a dichromat? No, because they're red-green colorblind. To a normal human being with normal color vision, yes, but today it's visible, and we can think counterfactually and say, if we were to bring one of today's human beings back before there was life on the planet and see this stratum, that human being would be able to, it would pop out. It would be visible to that human being. Now, that's a perfectly good counterfactual fact. And so it's okay to talk about the colors of things that have never been seen. As long as we know that when we do that, we're indexing our assertion to a particular kind of mind or observer. Now, I have a name for such properties, and I make a distinction between what I call suspect and lovely properties. There are facts that we can express, given our eyes, brains, minds, and language. These are objective facts, but to say they're perspectival is just to give it a label, not to explain it, really. So I'm going to say a little bit more. I wanted to distinguish between two kinds of properties which depend on they're sort of observer dependent in some ways. And it hit on me that the word suspect and lovely would do the trick just very well. You can be lovely even if nobody knows of your existence. But if we ask ourselves, that elephant seal over there, is she lovely? One of the most obnoxious looking creatures on the planet. Well, to a male elephant seal, yes, but not to us, unless we have very, very strange tastes. But there's no contradiction in talking about a lovely person, lovely woman, let's say, where we mean would impress with her loveliness any normally sighted human being who observed her. So you can be lovely without being observed, even though the property of loveliness is indexed to a class of observers. And do they have to be real observers? No. But you have to be able to describe them. But you can't be a suspect unless somebody actually suspects you. This is a property which is relative to an observer, to a mind, in a stronger way. You've committed a crime, There's evidence all over the place that you committed this crime, but nobody's twigged to it yet. Nobody's noticed. The police are baffled. You ask, am I a suspect? No, not yet. You're not a suspect until they suspect you. But you could be lovely before you'd been deemed lovely by somebody. And so it is with these reasons. Or numerosity. It's a lovely feature of things, whether or not there are counters. If you take a person who knows how to count back before there were people and ask her to count dinosaur eyes, the answer is 2, etc. Being how it is for a reason is a lovely feature of many things in the world. That's what free-floating rationales are all about. There are reasons why things have the properties they have, why they have some of the properties they have, but the reasons are free-floating until they're represented by a reasoner, and we're the first reasoners. Now you may understand why Peter Godfrey Smith says I suffer from Darwinian paranoia, because I don't shrink from this way of talking. I think this is okay. This is actually a useful way of talking, of filling the world with reasons that have never been reasoned about yet. I guess it's risky because Peter is a very smart person and he feels distinctly edgy about this and very unwilling to accept my way of thinking about this or my way of talking. And I admit that there are risks that can lead you to folly if you overindulge in this practice. But I also think that abstention is hopeless. You just cannot make sense of biology without playing this game. Biologists themselves indulge on an hourly basis, and they're doing just fine. Let's consider the caddis larva food sieve. If you want to see what a caddis larva looks like, there it is. It is the artificer of that. Now, these are built in a flowing freshwater stream. And as you can see from this elegant diagram by Hansel, the water comes in here, goes down through this chamber where there's a screen that's been erected covering the chamber, and then the water exits here. And food that comes in here gets caught on the screen. And the caddis larva can just pick food off the screen. And it can even get to both sides of the screen without going outside, because it has, this is the top view, you see it has this extra little chamber here so that it can work its way around. Pretty cool. You notice that I just gave you the reasons why the parts were organized as they are, what their purpose is. The screen is for catching food. This otherwise extremely improbable passage has a function. And this guy doesn't know what it is and doesn't have to know. Doesn't have to understand. It's like the termite. Well, here's another way of using a screen to get food out of water. And there's its maker. And what's the difference? There are reasons for the arrangements of parts in the lobster trap. Ask the guy, he'll tell you. But also in the caddis larva's food sieve. It's just that they're not represented anywhere. Not until some clever biologist decides to reverse engineer it and articulates for the first time ever the reasons that there are. This is a lovely property of the food trap, which has now been finally observed and articulated. Okay. I've shown you one strange inversion of reasoning, now I'm going to show you another. My two British heroes are Darwin and Turing. Then I have a Scottish hero, Hume. We'll get to him. So here's Turing's strange inversion of reasoning. Remember I showed you the pre-Darwinian worldview, the Sistine Chapel? Well, this isn't great art, but here's a representation of pre-Turing computers. They're wearing skirts. They were people. Before Turing, the word computer was a job description. And computers were hired by the thousands to work on tables, to do arithmetical calculations according to forms that had been carefully devised. And they did this for the Nautical Almanac and for various other tables in industry and in the government, weather forecasting, so forth. And in the old days, then, computers had to understand what arithmetic was. It was not an elevated job, but you had to have gone to school. You had to know what arithmetic was. You had to be able. A lot of these people were math majors. They'd read maths in college, and this was the only employment they could get that used their skills. They had to appreciate the reasons. And Turing recognized that this was not necessary. He took their activity and basically put it in a box, a black box, input problem, output solution. And he worked out how you could break down everything they did into a series of steps that could be performed by a purposeless, foresightless, intentionless little bit of machinery. Remember, this was what Mackenzie had to say about Darwin's idea. I'm going to vary this now and show you the parallel. In order to be a perfect and beautiful computing machine, it is not requisite to know what arithmetic is. True. This is Darwin's strange inversion. So the two of them together have discovered something, and this has now become a sort of bumper sticker for me: competence without comprehension, which initially strikes many people as paradoxical, and for good reason. Why do you go to university? You and your parents have said, wisely, because we want to be competent, and the way to be competent is to comprehend. Why do we turn our noses up at rote learning, at memorization? Why do we teach the principles? Because we think, and with justice, that the best way to be good at something is to understand it. not just do it by dumb rote practice, but to understand it, have comprehension. And that's why you become philosophy majors. You know, understand things, be able to explain them, not just dumbly follow some stupid routine that you've been, it's been drilled into you. And so this wise lore has been around for a long time, and it's right in its domain. By the way, I think its domain is more limited than a lot of people do. The recent history of educational experimentation, such as the so-called new math in the United States, dismal failure. The new math was the idea that instead of teaching kids counting and the multiplication table, you taught them set theory and some sort of abstract mathematical principles from which, indeed, counting and the multiplication table eventually emerges. And if you do understand the set theory, then cool, you've got some more understanding of what numbers are than you would otherwise. But it turned out to be a horrible way to teach people arithmetic. Rote learning, sheer memorization, has an important role to play. And in fact, one of the themes of these lectures is that comprehension, far from being the source of competence, is the effect of competence. Competences made out of competences made out of competences made out of competences. We have this hierarchy of competence and metacompetence, and when you get up high enough, we call it comprehension. And that's a sort of strange inversion, too. So Darwin and Turing together, in effect, conspire to show that mind, consciousness, understanding, it's not the original cause, as the traditional view would have it. It's an effect, and a fairly recent effect at that. So a little bit more now about free-floating rationales of evolution. An example I've been using for years is the cuckoo. As you know, cuckoos are, you may not know the technical term, they're brood parasites. They don't build their own nests. When the mother cuckoo is ready to lay her egg, she looks for another species of bird where the birds have already, like a reed warbler, say, have already made their nest and laid their eggs. She waits quietly in hiding until she sees the parents fly off to feed. She swoops down, lays her egg in the host nest, and then often, not always, rolls one of the host eggs out. Why? Why? That's in case the hosts can count. The hosts come back, they incubate the egg, the chick hatches before the host's eggs hatch. Why? So that the little fledgling cuckoo chick can do the next thing, which you see in the picture. There's some very moving footage of this on the internet, by the way. The little baby bird, it's still without feathers, it's practically blind, and it goes to tremendous labors to roll the other eggs out of the nest. Why? In order to maximize the return it gets from its adoptive parents. Doesn't want any sibling rivalry. This has been well studied. There's just no doubt about why this happens the way it does. So that's a free-floating rationale. There's a reason why the cuckoo rolls out an egg when she lays her own. There's a reason why the cuckoo chick pushes out the eggs when it hatches. In the same way that there's a reason why trees spread their branches. These are free-floating rationales. But in every case, they don't have to be appreciated by the beneficiaries. It's very natural to look at that little cuckoo and think that murderous mind of that little poor little baby bird. But don't worry, it doesn't know what it's doing. It doesn't have to feel guilty because it doesn't appreciate the reasons. It doesn't even understand what it's doing. It is the beneficiary of this sibling side, but it doesn't have to appreciate that fact to be the beneficiary. Just as we're the beneficiary every time we shiver when we're cold without having to know why it is, or even that we're a beneficiary. But we are. This is a good thing. A good thing. There's evolutionary normativity at work here, but we don't have to appreciate it. They need not be reason representers. Here's an even more tempting case, Stotting. You've no doubt seen documentary footage of lions or cheetahs chase or hyenas chasing a herd of gazelles or antelopes across the plain, and the gazelles are throwing these preposterous leaps, bounding, beautiful, but bounding way up high in the air. Have you all seen this? I didn't bother putting a film clip on. Everybody knows. All right. Why are they doing that? Why? That seems very wasteful. Seems risky. Doesn't seem to be helping them get away from the lion. Well, here's the free-floating rationale. The antelope is telling the lion, don't bother chasing me. I can make these energetically expensive leaps and still outrun you. Go after my cousin who can't. So it's like that Darwinian joke about the two campers in the Arctic, camped out in their sleeping bags and on the ice floe, and they wake up in the morning and they see this polar bear coming towards them. One of them quick starts putting on his sneakers, and the other one says, you don't think those sneakers are going to help you outrun the polar bear? He says, no, I just think they're going to help me outrun you. Intra-specific competition in evolution is more important than competition between predator and prey. So that's what the gazelle is doing, and it is important that this be costly, that this be energetically costly, that this be risky, because this is an example of costly signaling theory. Amit Zahavi, Israeli evolutionist, first put this idea forward, and some years ago. And a lot of people were very dismissive of it at first, but it's held its own very well and been articulated and proved in many experimental situations. It's a game theoretic point. You can think about why this should be the case very simply. So these leaps have a meaning. They mean, don't bother chasing me, I'm too good for you. Well, why wouldn't a little tail wag do the same thing, or an ear flick, or a bleat? Because it wouldn't be costly, and it wouldn't be credible. If you could signal to the lion, don't go after me, I'm too fast, by doing those simple things, then everybody would do it. And so the lions wouldn't have any reason to believe. They only have a reason to believe when it's costly. So the lion believes, look, I put that in scare quotes, this communicative act. But here's the important point. Neither the gazelle nor the lion needs to understand this speech act. Well, then is this just a fantasy? This free-floating rationale? No. It's good, objective science. It's predictive. It explains, as Elizabeth Anscombe once mysteriously said, an order which is there in this interaction. In spite of the fact that the individual organisms don't have to understand it. We understand it because we're explainers. We're reason representers. The beneficiaries, and they're both beneficiaries. The lion doesn't waste energy going after things it can't catch, and the gazelle saves its life if it's strong enough to do so. There are many examples of this. This is just a particularly vivid one. So this gives us an interesting example of communication without comprehension. It's a kind of communication. Hint, an awful lot of communication is of this kind. Communication that does have comprehension, which is, of course, our model of communication, is a fairly recent development. I think that's a good place to stop the morning lecture, isn't it? We've gone, yeah. So let's now have some time for questions.
You want the questions?
Yeah, yeah. Questions now, yeah. I'll try to keep my answers shorter than yesterday.
My first question is about the reverse engineering you were talking about.
Yep.
You were talking about Darwin and the Cadi, and then about Alan Turing taking human processes and doing the computer. To what extent can you get to that? Because it's very subjective when you do the reverse engineering. If you took a software program, the person that does it will see something, and when you try to do the reverse engineering, you will see it in a different way.
I'm sorry, I didn't get that last phrase.
That there is the person that does the reverse engineering, and it's a subjective interpretation of what you are trying to reverse engineer. How do you work with that?
You're suggesting that reverse engineering in general is too subjective?
No, I think in some cases. I think when...
in some cases.
Yes, I was wondering to what extent you can use the reverse engineering. You cannot use the reverse engineering in the economy, for example. There are lots of variables, or in some things in nature.
Well, reverse engineering only works for things that are designed. Whether they're designed by evolution or whether they're designed by designers, human intelligent designers or design teams. And there are lots of things which are, say, the interactions between design things which are not themselves designed. I would think the economy would be a pretty good example of that. But to the point about subjectivity, or I would rather say that reverse engineering has its limits, and it can often sort of reach a limit where no more progress can be made because, and this is This is an important Quinean point, because the indeterminacy of radical translation sets in at some point, and you've got two different interpretations for why something is the way it is, and they are equally good explaining all the facts you've got. Quine's doctrine of the indeterminacy of radical translation is a special case of the shortcomings of reverse engineering. When you see it that way, it makes a lot more sense than, I mean, people struggle to make sense of this, Quine's doctrine. I'm very confident that this is what it really is. And this would be an interesting topic for further discussion. It's possible, what Quine was arguing was, it's possible in principle for two exercises of reverse engineering to explain all the facts that anybody can drum up or even think of drumming up and be different explanations, and there simply be no fact of the matter of what the right explanation is. They're both equally good. It almost never happens. It's a very unstable circumstance. I wanted to demonstrate this to my students, so I created a crossword puzzle. Just a 4x4 square with definitions for one across, one down, two down, three down, four down, five across, six across, seven across. So we've got four definitions for across, four definitions for down. And I hand it out to the students, and I say, solve it. And it's not trivial, but they get it. And then when they hand them in, I go through, and it never has not happened, I get two different solutions. You can't imagine how many hours I spent making a crossword puzzle that had two different solutions. The constraints that you have to meet are, try it yourself and you'll soon discover. But there, that's about as elaborate an example as I can give, where when you reverse engineer the thing, you know, the students want to know, well, what's the right answer? Well, no, neither one of them is the right answer. I deliberately set out to create something so that there were two equally good and equally satisfying solutions to the problem. And if you only find one, you think it's the only one. Because in general, what I've called the cryptographer's constraint applies. If you've got some ciphertext and you can get a translation of it, you don't worry about whether there's another one. If you found a translation, you found the translation, just because the constraints are so great. So, in general, for reverse engineering, or as David Lewis called it, radical interpretation, which is reverse engineering in the domain of psychology, there's always the theoretical risk of explaining all the objective facts and not having that provide you with a unique reverse engineering account. But it's a possibility in principle that is ignorable in practice. Does that answer your question? Where are the next? Let me see if I've got your questions right. First, you want an account of what the Darwinian explanation of our mathematical ability, the evolution of our mathematical ability is. That's question one. And the second question is whether that this is a sort of Platonism that I'm endorsing, or I didn't.
There are the opinion that the mathematics is a free creation of our mind. But I think a Darwinian explanation is in the middle of the two. It's not Platonism and it's not...
Okay. Well, let me see if I agree with you. I'm not sure. We know that animals have an innately genetically transmitted numerical sense, which can be, and we have it too. And mathematics, represented arithmetic, for instance, is a sort of prosthetic extension and clarification of a more animal sense of number. And there's, I think, no doubt what the free-floating rationale for having a sense of numerosity is. Experiments have been done to explore this in animals. One of my favorites involves seeing how well seals can count. There's a rocky ledge off the coast of Maine where there are a lot of seals at low tide. And in the old days, the sealers, the men who were going out to hunt seals, they'd get five or six in a boat and they'd row out to the ledge and the seals would all go into the water and get the heck off the reef. And one of the men in the boat would hide down behind a rock, and the rest of them would get in the rowboat and row away. And the question is, would the seals come back? Or could they count and say, wait a minute, six landed and only five left? And well, they can count to three, but of course they don't have words for numbers, but they're sensitive up to about that level. I think maybe, do you know any better results than that? Yeah, it's an approximation. It's a more of a sort of an analog sense than a digitized arithmetical sense. So we use genetic evolution to explain that native animal sense of numerosity, and then we use cultural evolution, we'll get to that, to explain the thinking tools that have evolved by cultural evolution to inhabit our brains and add to our powers. Now, some of those are intelligently designed thinking tools. Couldn't get much more intelligent than Newton and Leibniz. Calculus is a thinking tool par excellence, which didn't just evolve. It was the artifact of two human beings who evolved. So does that answer the first question about what the evolutionary account of our arithmetical talents is? I didn't go into the details, of course. Now, as to whether this is sort of in between Platonism and a sense that mathematics is our creation, I have always thought that there was a position which was really obligatory, I couldn't see any way around it, which was in a sense in between Platonism and sort of a human creation view. Because It's what I call a good trick, with a capital G, capital T. Evolution, in the design space, there are places where there are many paths in evolutionary space which will all end up there. Eyes are a good trick. They've evolved several times. Wings, flying is a really good trick. Having a metabolism is an absolutely good trick. You can't be alive without it. There are various, if you look at convergent evolution, it converges on good tricks, and that's a nice way of thinking about it, because in design space, there are good tricks. Marvin Minsky had an elegant but hard to follow argument for why there can only be one arithmetic. What are these good tricks? They're regions in design space. Well, is that a timeless Platonic thing? Well, I suppose in a way it is. But it seems to me it's an innocent Platonism. It doesn't involve any weird metaphysics about how immaterial minds can grasp and have acquaintance with Platonic entities in some sort of Platonic heaven, because you've sort of naturalized that through the idea of good tricks. At least that doesn't do the whole thing, but that's as good as I can do on that.
So about the two kinds of reasons why X does whatever and reasons for which X does whatever, what's the relationship between those two? Thinking about systems like us who can have both, well, how do we manage?
You have a reason if you have it represented in your psychology, and it is available to reason about. You can be talked into it or out of it. You can be persuaded. You can persuade yourself.
So there is no reasons for which I do X without me having a language? Is that corollary of what you said?
You see, here's where I put the spike on the railroad and joined Pittsburgh to Darwin. Mm-hmm. And I say the space of reasons.
Yeah, you sound very Pittsburgh right now.
The space of reasons is language bound. It's okay. The game of persuasion and explanation. And we're the only explainers, persuaders. Now, what I just said is, I think, properly seen as a somewhat risky empirical claim. I don't want to make it definitional. I'm happy to consider evidence that a dog can persuade itself to do one thing rather than another, in some sense of persuade itself. It's not talking to itself, but it has some psychological process which is tantamount to self-persuasion or explanation. I think it's extremely unlikely, and I don't see any empirical evidence for it.
So when you talk about...
I think this is part of my human exceptionalism, and it makes dog lovers hate me sometimes, because I really don't think dogs understand half of what their owners think they understand, and they don't have to understand it, and they don't give any evidence of understanding it. And all you have to do is watch a dog on a leash wrap itself around a tree and see its pathetic inability to undo that. And you begin to realize that Dogs are not quite as smart as their owners think they are. Another pet example of mine is dolphins. Golly, they're smart. People sing hymns to the intelligence of dolphins all the time. Then tell me, why do we have to have scuba divers helping them jump over fishing nets? They're very good jumpers, but if you get a purse seine and begin to close in on some tuna, and there's dolphins inside the net, you know, they have now, because of all the outcry, they have to have scuba divers that go over the side to show the dolphins how to get out of the net. Well, you know, that's not rocket science. And you'd think that a dolphin would be smart enough to realize, I can jump 6 feet out of the water. But it seems that they have to be shown this. So they're not so smart.
Sorry, but this point of view, it's not a Cartesianism point of view, because for reasoning with myself, I need this capacity to talk about me and not with my body. And for example, this the dolphin have the intention, for example, I can see the intention to jump, but maybe not this capacity to reasoning. But I think maybe this special capacity for the humans, it's only a invention or Cartesian or result is an effect of Cartesianism point of view.
I'm sorry, just
to... No, sorry. Cartesianism point of view, maybe.
It's a consequence of...
Yeah. Sorry.
Okay. Descartes was right about a lot of things. He was wrong about the immaterial res cogitans in one sense, but he was right about its powers as a cogitans in some sense. The capacity to think thoughts is, in our day, made much of by who, among others? Chomskyans? People like Fodor? Chomsky writes a book called Cartesian Linguistics. And they are the champions of what's sometimes called an intellectualism. And it's not stupid. It's just much more limited than they think. Fodor is usefully extreme, as often. And actually, he and Gareth Evans, for that matter, put forward the generality constraint, which says that you can't think the thought, you know, that Bob loves Mary unless you can think the thought that Mary loves Bob. That if you've got a transitive concept verb, as it were, they're thinking of thinking as sort of in words or something, in concepts, but they have a language of thought view, and they think that in order to be able to think any thought, you have to be able to think all the thoughts within the system, which has slots of various sorts. So if you couldn't think that Tom was taller than Bill, and Bill was taller than Sally, unless you could also think that Fred was taller than George, and Sally was taller than Sue. That you either have the system or you don't. That's, I take it, the generality constraint. Well, but that means that a gazelle can't think, the lion wants to eat me, unless it can also think, I want to eat the lion. Well, now you see, that's a good reason, actually. You cling to the generality constraint. You say, okay, gazelles can't think. But they do something like thinking. They are intentional systems that have the beliefs that might be expressed a little bit impressionistically as the lion wants to eat me. But it isn't, don't intellectualize them too much. So I think that the generality constraint and similar principles are actually useful idealizations of what it is to have reasons and give reasons. But we do have to remember they're idealizations. And we apply them as necessary requirements at our peril, because there can be things which are only approximately rational agents. In fact, nothing is ever anything better than approximately a rational agent. Okay, does that deal with your question? Okay, time for coffee.